When I met you, girl, my heart went knock-knock. Now the butterflies on my stomach won't stop-stop. Even though it's a struggle, love is all we got. So we gon' keep climbing to the mountaintop.
We already know that teen tastes drive the pop charts today, but new research shows that their brains might also predict hits of the future. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show, the musical secrets lurking in the brains of teenagers. Plus, we hear about a recent concert at the city's largest jail complex, Rikers Island, and a live performance from singer-songwriter Jolie Holland. But first, Emory University just released a new study that could change our understanding of why some songs make it big, like this one from Justin Bieber, and others flop. Scientists monitored the brain activity of teenagers while they listened to over 100 unfamiliar songs, and what they found was that songs that created the most activity in the brain often went on to be the most popular tunes of tomorrow, almost as if the teens were picking the hits. We're joined now by Gregory Burns, who led the study. He's director of Emory University's Center of Neuropolicy. Greg, welcome to Soundcheck.
Great to be here, John.
So what did you find exactly?
Well, the study started over 5 years ago in 2006, and the original purpose was to understand how peer pressure affects teenage decision-making.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we found was actually an accident. So we started by looking at music because everyone has an opinion about music. Everyone has likes and dislikes. And more importantly, you were kind of inundated with these five-star ratings. You know, you go on Amazon and you see if a song is 4 or 5 stars. And the original question was, do those ratings make you like something more or less? And in order to answer the question, we had to choose songs that people hadn't heard before.
Mm-hmm.
And so we actually went to MySpace and downloaded 120 songs of, at the time, artists who were relatively unknown, or most of them were simply unsigned artists who just put their music there. And what we did was we had a group of teenagers go in an MRI scanner and scan their brains while they listened to these songs. And so we were trying to capture what we call the reward center responses to the songs themselves, kind of a neural measure of how much they like it.
And this, I guess this also is something that perhaps is a measure, a countermeasure to what teenagers would tell you afterwards when they might say they liked a song that they didn't or didn't like a song that they did. The brain doesn't lie, right?
Well, let's say it has a mind of its own.
Uh-huh.
But we actually did it both ways. We actually asked the kids to rate the songs and how much they liked it.
Mm-hmm.
We asked them also to rate how familiar it was, because it's well known that things that are familiar to you, you tend to like more.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had the brain responses. And actually what happened was we finished the study, we published it, and then several years went by, and I was watching American Idol with my kids, and on comes Chris Allen, and he sings the song Apologize by One Republic. And it turned out that was one of the songs that we had used in our study 3 years before that, even before One Republic was signed to a label. And so we started to wonder, was there something in that data set that could have predicted that becoming a hit? And so we went back and looked at the data, and it turns out there was actually something there in the kids' brains that we were picking up.
So you were getting a lot more activity when those kids were listening to this song by the band One Republic, the song called Apologize, which would go on to be a hit.
I'm holding on your rope, got me 10 feet off the ground. And I'm hearing what you say, but I just can't make you sound.
So That's the song Apologize by the then unknown One Republic. Back in 2006, Dr. Gregory Burns and the rest of the gang there at Emory University used that as one of the 100-plus obscure songs for a peer pressure study. And so, Greg, you're watching American Idol, you hear that song, you go running back to your original data. Was there more brain activity for this One Republic song than for most of the other songs that the kids had been listening to?
Well, it turned out to be a little bit more complicated than that. So even though One Republic sold a lot of albums in that case, it was not the song that elicited the most activity out of specific regions of the brain, although it was actually in the top 20 mm-hmm. in terms of brain activation. So that's pretty good. So then we started looking at all the other songs, and we had to go kind of comb through databases of sales to figure out, you know, which songs were successful based on how many units they sold, and then try to link that back up with the brain activity.
And how did you define a hit song? What's a successful song in this study?
Well, good question. So we started with the industry standard definition of 500,000 units, basically a gold record. Mm-hmm. And there were only a few songs that met that definition. And we couldn't predict those particular songs. Those, for example, were not the top three in terms of brain activation. So then we started asking the question, well, you know, what if we relax the definition of a hit, say, to 100,000 or 50,000? And there was a certain point, what we would call the sweet spot, of around between 20 and 50,000 units that the brain data was actually pretty good at predicting whether that song would go on to sell more or less than that amount. So that's a long way from an industry standard definition of a hit, but it's still meaningful data in terms of predicting hit songs.
Mm-hmm. So how good... I mean, let's just say right off the bat, to repeat something that you had mentioned earlier, that this was not the original intent of the study. Nobody knew that they were taking this test that years later would be used, you know, that the results would be parsed in this way. How effective, how good were these teens at, you know, picking songs that would go on to sell 20,000 units or more?
Well, if we take the 20,000 threshold, the brain data could predict about a third of the songs that would sell more than that.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually even better at predicting kind of the other side, the duds. It could predict about 80 to 90% of the songs that would not sell that many.
So when you don't see a whole lot of brain activity in those, you call them reward centers in the brain, you can be pretty sure that that song's going nowhere.
Yeah, surprising as it is.
Well, I mean, teens do make up, an important part of the market, although I'm told they only make up 20% of the buying public. Older listeners actually spend more money. How important is this sort of thing in the marketplace, in the real world?
You know, it's a great question. And, I mean, there's a lot of data out there from the recording industry on who's buying music, who's listening to music and not buying it, of which you might argue that the younger demographic is actually, you know, listening to a lot of music that's possibly not captured in the industry sales data.
Yeah.
The other side of it is, you know, we scanned the kids when they were between the age of 12 and 17 and then basically followed the songs and the albums for another 3 years. So they actually moved out of the demographic into young adults, you know, early 20s. So in that range, I mean, that's a big market of, you know, the music consuming public.
Mm-hmm. How big was your group? It was 27 subjects, right?
Yeah, basically we started with 32 kids. Five of them we couldn't use because they moved their head too much in the scanner, and so we only had 27 kids.
Was gender at all affecting the results?
No, you know, we looked for all the usual things that you might predict, you know, whether it was gender, age. And the other thing that was interesting about it was that when we looked at the kids' ratings of the songs, of, you know, simply just asking them, how much did you like this mm-hmm. song, that did not predict any of the sales data. It was as if when we asked them, they couldn't tell us, but their brains had some hidden information in there that could.
As you said, the brains having a mind of their own. Let's talk about the songs that were at the top and the bottom of this list of 120 songs you played for the kids 5 years ago. It seems like metal in particular did very well with your demographic, right?
Well, right. And let's be clear. We're talking about the demographic's brains, not necessarily what they said.
Right.
But you're right. We found that in terms of the brain activation in the reward centers, there were several metal songs that were up there in the top 20, which kind of brings up the point that the study's not really about pop music. It's about music that becomes popular. And all the genres were really represented in kind of the top 10 or 20 of brain activation. That's everything, you know, from metal to country to hip-hop and rock in between.
All right. Well, the top-ranked song, the most brain activity, happened when the kids listened to this band called Job for a Cowboy. Science suggests that whether you like the song or not, your brain is frantically processing stuff in your reward center, listening to Job for a Cowboy and the song called Knee Deep. It'd be interesting, Greg, to do a study like this with older, you know, with older or younger listeners. Is there something about the teenage brain? Is it somehow more plastic, more pliable, better for this sort of test?
It's a good question. I mean, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, one thing we can say about the younger brains is that they tend to respond with more brain activation to a lot of things than the older brains.
Mm.
Maybe it's worn out neurons, or maybe it's just the older you get, it's just kind of hard to be impressed by anything. I don't know.
So whether the kids liked those that song or not, this is the one where you saw the most brain activity in the MRIs.
That's right.
Okay. And then at the bottom of the list, song number 120 out of 120 was this group called Red Snow. That is a song called Perfect Nowhere by Red Snow, and according to this Emory University study, you would expect Perfect Nowhere to end up absolutely nowhere. This is, as Dr. Gregory Burns has been telling us, the teenage brains and the MRI mapping that was done in the study predicted with 80 to 90% accuracy the songs that would not do well, that would sell fewer than 20,000 units. Greg, how much of that is marketing? I mean, just the fact that it's so hard for anything to sell 20,000 units these days, you know, seems like, you know, if you gave me a random list of 100 songs, you know, 90 of them would probably not reach that mark anyway, right?
Yeah, and this is really why it was totally surprising to us, because, you know, there are so many songs out there now. And really, the bar is pretty low for putting a song out there. You know, anyone, you know, with some decent recording equipment and a computer in their basement can record something and put it up for sale on iTunes. So part of the problem is there's so much music available now, much more than there used to be.
So maybe the impressive thing then isn't that they're picking the flops with such great accuracy, but that they're picking the hits. Even at 33%, which doesn't sound like a great batting average, you know, in this case, is that even more impressive in this marketplace?
I do think it's impressive because, I mean, you could take 100 songs and just, you know, like you said, 90% of those are not going to go anywhere just because the odds are stacked against them. So the ability to find anything, even slightly predictive, is pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. And this slightly predictive ability in the brains of the teenage subjects in the study is what we're talking about today with Dr. Gregory Burns, a neuroeconomist and director of Emory University's Center of Neuropolicy. Greg, we have a caller on the line with a question for you. Ted is joining us on the line from Brooklyn. Hi, Ted.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
All right, you got a question.
Yeah, quick question about the reptilian brain. I mean, your first, the number one on your list seems like if you were to take this, you know, the modern electronic technology off of it and put a bunch of guys, you know, in tribal paint, and you would create that same song. I wonder if there's something deeper going on in the reptilian brain because of the primal nature of metal or hip-hop or some of the songs that you had used in your test.
Interesting question, Greg.
That's a great question, Ted. And it turns out that the brain areas that we actually focused on, you know, many people would call the reptilian brain. And for the other folks out there, the reptilian brain is kind of this deep part of our brain, sits right above the brain stem, mm-hmm. and is associated with basic drives. And in fact, those are the parts of the brain that we looked at. And I think you might be right that there's something very primitive about the powerful rhythms, at least in that metal song. But, you know, one thing we tried to do, we tried to analyze actually all of the sonic or spectral patterns of the songs to see what was driving these responses, and we couldn't find anything with that. And, you know, the fact that all these different genres were represented in the top 10 of brain activation, I think, speaks to the fact that there's not a single formula for a hit.
Now, we mentioned before, you started with 32 teenage subjects. Five of them were moving their heads too much, so you couldn't get a good, clean MRI. You ended up with 27. Is that a big enough sample to extrapolate anything meaningful from this study?
You wouldn't think it would be. Now, you know, when we do these studies, it's kind of expensive to do MRI studies, so we usually shoot for samples of about 30 people as mm-hmm. being, quote, representative of the population. And so the issue is generally, are those people representative of everyone else? And you would think that 30 is not enough. But it all depends on kind of what you're trying to represent. And if, in terms of music, maybe they are. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
All right. We've got some comments. Let's head into the control room where Joel Meyer, our producer, has some of what's coming in over the transom, the digital transom on the website. Joel?
John, a couple of skeptics on our site. Edward from New Jersey writes, couldn't the difference between 50,000 and 500,000 simply be marketing? And Nick from the Upper West Side writes, it's a real shame that today's teens respond the most strongly to that hideous psychotic racket. What kind of minds do teenagers have now? What kind of people are we generating? And I think I can just hear the screams of why from here in the control room, John. And Suzanne from Manhattan posts this, my cat really liked that metal song. She came up to the radio and stared at it. She never does that.
So maybe you're activating the cat's reptilian brain as well with that thing. I guess it's important. One of our listeners, you know, talking about what kind of brains do these kids have. The point again, Greg, is you're not saying that they necessarily liked the songs at the top of the list. Just that that's where the most brain activity was, right?
It's an interesting distinction. It's what they said they didn't like. Now, there are a couple possibilities for that. The first is, when you ask somebody how much they like something, especially a song, it's kind of hard to answer that. It's like, well, what's a one, what's a five, and I don't know, compare it to something else. It's you have to think about it. There's that, and then there's also the fact that maybe you don't want to reveal to me that you like metal or you like country because it's not cool. So it's possible that the brain imaging can kind of get past that those issues.
All right. Well, the study, kind of an accidental discovery. Just out of curiosity, what did you find with the peer pressure thing, the original point of this whole study? Do kids change their opinions of songs based on what other kids are saying?
Some kids do change their answers. They tend to be younger and seemingly more influenced by the crowd. And the mechanism of that seemed in our original experiment to be motivated out of a discomfort of being different.
Hmm. Well, there were 120 songs that you gave these 27 teens to listen to. And the top-selling song out of the 120, the big hit, actually ranked number 33. So they didn't quite pick this one, either, I guess, verbally or with their MRIs. But this is Mark Wills and a song called Don't Laugh at Me. We've been speaking with Dr. Gregory Burns, neuroeconomist at Emory University and director of the university's Center of Neuropolicy. Greg, it's a really interesting study. Thanks for sharing it with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
This is Soundcheck.
To cry myself to sleep. I'm that kid on every playground who's always chosen last.
Up next, we'll hear about a recent concert that you probably missed, and here's why. It took place at the prison complex on Rikers Island. And later, a live performance here in our studio from singer-songwriter Jolie Holland. This is Soundcheck.
Can't believe you're treating me like all those girls, all those sweet girls go home to cry. And